This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The other thing is, you know, Israel is definitely not interested in an independent government that would run Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Hamas is definitely not interested. I believe it also rejected the plan.
That was Imad Harb, director of research at the Arab Center in Washington, speaking about Egypt's draft proposal for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Details coming up also. The United Nations struggles to end conflicts around the world. And South Sudanese find ways to address their community concerns. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Ethiopia became Africa's third nation to default on debt in as many years today after it failed to make a $33 million coupon payment on its only international government bond. Reuters News reports that Africa's second most populous country announced earlier this month that it intended to formally go into default. It has been under severe financial strain in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic and a two-year civil war that ended in November 2022. It was supposed to make the payment on December 11th, but technically had up until today to provide the money due to a 14-day grace period in the $1 billion bond agreement. Reuters says, according to the two sources, bondholders had not been paid the coupon as of the end of last Friday, the last international banking working day before the grace period expires. Ethiopian government officials did not respond to requests for comment on Friday or over the weekend, but the default means Ethiopia joins two other African nations, Zambia and Ghana, in a full-scale common framework restructuring. In South Sudan, some people have created digital forums to evade a government ban on gatherings across the country. After the country's December 2013 conflict, WhatsApp became one of social media applications South Sudanese use to express their opinions without fear of reprisal. Tong Dengani is a moderator of WhatsApp group called Sunrise. He tells VOA's John Tanza, the forum aims to give the South Sudanese an opportunity to discuss important issues in their communities.
Sunrise is just a platform of South Sudanese, which we thought about it in 2018, because we came to realize that South Sudanese have issues that they need to share and they lack the platform where they can share their ideas, where they can express their opinion. So we created the WhatsApp groups, just as a small group, and we developed the regulation that is governing the group. And the group grown bigger. It's now grown, like it has 510 people. So, and this group actually brought a lot of professional, South Sudanese professional from across the country, out from the diaspora, from people who are living outside South Sudan, but they are South Sudanese. And it actually became a very important platform for South Sudanese professional. So this year, it has been a very good, actually. We were having a lot of issues that we were discussing. And one of them was the issue of the water, when there was this issue of dredging that was coming up.
The dredging of River Nam.
Yes, the dredging of the River Nam was one of the great topics that was being discussed intensively, because all the South Sudanese across the country were against the dredging. Because if the dredging take place, it will actually reduce the level of water in the country. And the places that, like, not only the Nile, but places that are also benefiting from the water in the Sud region will dry up. For example, talk about the rainforest in Western Equatoria and Congo. The rainforest in Western Equatoria and Congo, they get their water from the Sud. When there is a vibration, the wind moves the water to the cloud to Western Equatoria, and that is the rainforest which is there. And the rainforest come from these places. And if we give this water away, it means that even our forest will disappear. Mm-hmm. We will not have resources. And our natural resources will disappear. All the wildlife that we have in South Sudan, they will all disappear. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we need to preserve. And we want to make sure that we give pressure to the government to make sure that the dredging does not take place so that our water are not taken away.
Apart from the issue of the dredging of River Nam, what were some of the issues that dominated discussions on Sunrise?
The other issues were also the issue of food security, because people also, the country actually had been having issues of chronic food insecurity across South Sudan, except there are few areas like the Greenbelt area, that is Western Equatoria. And now this year, Jonglei also show a very good sign that they have enough food for themselves. But that alone, the food in Western Equatoria, don't go to other places where there's no food. The food in Reng doesn't go to other places where there's no food. So because of access, there is why we talk about food availability and access to food. You might have access availability in the market, but some would have no money to buy it. You might have food in other places like in Reng, in Western Equatoria, but there are no roads that where the traders can take this food to other places. And these are the issues that has been discussed. So a bigger population of the country, they are food insecure, in a simple word. They are food insecure, and they don't have access to food. And this is an issue that has been discussed intensively. And people were urging, actually, the government and private sector to create accessibility by opening the road up so that people can be able to do that and support the small agriculture, so that people are able to produce more than what they have. So the other issue that was discussed, apart from food security, was the health care. Because in South Sudan, we have health professionals, but the problem we have in the country are the lack of facilities. There are no facilities. And you know, when there are no facilities, for people to diagnose the real issues that are affecting the people, they cannot do anything.
And but there are clinics around town. I've been driving around town. There are clinics. There's Juba Teaching Hospital and other facilities there. Are you talking about lack of equipment or you're talking about lack of manpower?
No, actually, what I'm talking about is the lack of equipment. The lack of equipment is a big issue because there is no equipment that can diagnose the real issue. Some of the people that you see that they are going to Egypt, they are going to Kenya, they are going to Uganda, are being transferred by our doctors because they are not able to do more investigation. And that's why they have to send them to other places where they have the better facilities, they will be able to investigate. But now, the question is, how many people can go there? That's the big question. Because not everybody that have resources to fly here to Kenya, to Uganda, to Egypt, to go and get healthcare.
So you're talking about affordability.
People are not empowered economically. So a lot of people have no job, a lot of people have no money, so they cannot be able to afford healthcare outside the country. And this is a big issue. So, and these are the issues that we are discussing. How best can we strengthen our healthcare so that our people are treated locally here?
That's Tong Dengani, a former Minister of Health in Northern Bahir El Ghazal Estate and a moderator of Sunrise Group. He spoke with VOA's John Tanza in Juba. Militants from the Islamist group Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, burned a grandmother and two children to death on Christmas Day in western Uganda. According to the French news agency AFP, the attack in a remote village of Kamwengi comes a week after the ADF fighters killed 10 people in the same area. Kamwengi resident District Commissioner Isaiah Bayarugaba told AFP the attackers set a home ablaze with the victims inside. The army and police were pursuing the attackers, he added. ADF is accused of having massacred thousands of civilians in the Democratic Republic of Congo in recent years and of carrying out attacks over the border on Ugandan soil. Originally a Muslim-majority coalition of armed Ugandan groups, the ADF says it is now affiliated with Islamic State militant group. The DRC and Uganda launched joint military operations against the ADF in November 2021, but the rebel attacks have continued. New wars and growing hunger and poverty on a warming planet, and little the United Nations can do to fix it. VOA correspondent Margaret Bashir looks at the UN's future in a world where its impact is shrinking.
In 2023, the war in Ukraine entered its second year, with no peace on the horizon. Military coups destabilized parts of Africa, and new and deadly wars arose in Sudan and the Middle East. The United Nations has had little success in stopping the bloodshed. Anjali Dayal teaches international relations at New York's Fordham University.
It's particularly been challenging because the kinds of conflicts the UN has been facing over the last year have been exactly the kinds of conflicts that the UN is least well-equipped to manage. They're conflicts between the big permanent members of the Security Council. And when those countries are involved, the UN has the least scope for action.
That's because Britain, China, France, Russia, and the United States can use their vetoes to block sanctions and other tools the Council can use to maintain peace and security. This past year, geopolitical divisions intensified over Russia's war in Ukraine, and since October, Washington's support for Israel's war against Hamas. Richard Gowan is UN Director for the International Crisis Group.
And the mood in the Security Council now is poisonous.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres was unable to unblock the paralysis by invoking in December the rarely used Article 99 of the UN Charter to press the Council for a humanitarian ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. The United States vetoed his appeal, and Israel called for his resignation. The news wasn't much better for the UN's peacekeeping efforts in the field. The organization's blue helmets mark 75 years of peace operations this year. But the anniversary comes as Mali and the Democratic Republic of Congo demand that UN forces leave their territory, and as Haiti appeals for an international force to help stabilize the country, just not a UN one. In Africa, leaders are turning more to forces drawn from regional blocs to deal with sub-Saharan crises. This, along with peacekeeping's hefty annual budget of more than $6 billion, has prompted questions about the efficiency, value, and need for present and future missions. Head of UN Peace Operations, Jean-Pierre Lacroix.
Moving forward, what we think we should work together with the member states on is to make sure that UN peacekeeping operation, when they are warranted, will be fit for purpose. And when it's about enforcement, not peacekeeping, then it's not for UN peacekeeping to do enforcement, it's for other form of operation.
One hopeful moment came at the COP28 climate conference in Dubai. Delegates agreed for the first time on the need to move away from fossil fuels, a major driver of global warming. With climate change intensifying natural disasters, conflicts, and other global shocks, the UN has been called upon more to mobilize delivery of humanitarian assistance. Again, Fordham University professor Anjali Dayal.
We see both things, right? We see that even when there's diminished political space to broker political solutions to conflicts or to human crises, there's still the real potential to do important, significant work on the humanitarian scale, but it has to be funded, it has to be supported in order to get the sort of greatest impact.
Over decades, many have called for reforms to the UN, including expanding Security Council representation to reflect current realities. Again, Crisis Group analyst Richard Gowan.
The UN was paralyzed for long periods of the Cold War. So the fact that it is once again going through a period of crisis doesn't mean that it's dead. I think there is a real need to think about the structures of the UN and how they could be changed.
The problem, the analysts say, is there is little consensus on how to change the organization for the better. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip continues as it pushes its effort to eliminate the Hamas organization. Since October 7th, when Hamas militants attacked communities in Israel, killing nearly 1,200 people, the Gaza Health Ministry says nearly 21,000 residents of Gaza have died in the Israeli offensive. The World Food Programme says more than one in four households in Gaza face extreme hunger, and there is a risk of famine in the territory unless food supplies, clean water, health and sanitation services are restored. The data come from a new Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, report released this week. IPC is a multi-stakeholder platform that analyzes data to determine the severity and magnitude of hunger crisis across to internationally recognized scientific standards. The survey shows that all of Gaza's 2.2 million people are in crisis levels of acute food security or worse. In a video supplied by the WFP, the United Nations Agency's chief economist, Arif Hussein, says the situation is dire.
What is happening in Gaza is unprecedented, both in terms of its scale, but also how quickly it is happening. You know, in the world right now, there are about 130,000 people who are in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're starving. In Gaza, more than 500,000. That is four times more. And that is what makes this totally unprecedented.
He called for a rapid increase in aid supplies into Gaza.
We can still avoid this famine, but we need to make sure that people have food, people have water, they have shelter, they have sanitation. And for all of those things to happen, we need border crossings open so these commodities can come in. And then we need to make sure that they can reach people, which means we need access pretty much everywhere throughout the Gaza Strip. And that is only possible if there is a humanitarian ceasefire.
Limited supply has trickled into Gaza since the fighting began through the Rafah border crossing in Egypt and now through the Kerem Shalom crossing Israel. But aid agencies say the amount is far less than what is needed to ease the humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, Egypt has put forward an ambitious initial proposal to end the Israeli-Hamas war with a ceasefire, a phased hostage release, and the creation of a Palestinian government of experts who would administer Gaza and the occupied West Bank, a senior Egyptian official and a European diplomat said on Monday. The proposal, worked out with the Gulf nation of Qatar, has been presented to Israel, Hamas, the United States, and European governments, but still appears to be preliminary. Imad Harb, director of research at the Arab Center in Washington, discussed this proposal with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Considering the situation on the ground, it really seems unrealistic. The question is, you know, what kind of government are we talking about and who participates? Will there be any really respectful Palestinian personalities who would agree to come and join a technocratic government that comes really on the shoulders of an Israeli occupation or Israeli attack? The other thing is, you know, Israel is definitely not interested in an independent government that would run Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Hamas is definitely not interested. I believe it also rejected the plan. It's asking for an end of hostilities and basically independent Palestinian action and decision-making. So as long as the U.S. backs Israel, I don't see how, you know, Israel can be forced into a compromise on this issue. Besides, the Israeli government is on record and Netanyahu is on record saying that he is definitely interested in finding another home for the Palestinians in Gaza. This is why the plan is, to me, is unrealistic. It just does not address the situation on the ground.
But the Egyptian proposal depends on creating a government to rule Gaza and occupied West Bank for a transitional period as Palestinian factions settle their disputes and agree on a roadmap to hold presidential and parliamentary elections. Is that doable?
I don't think it's doable. First of all, we have to talk about an end of hostilities. I mean, we can't talk about the day after before Israel can accept the ceasefire and the killing of Palestinians. Israel is actually working on depopulating the Gaza Strip. What's there to be doable about this? When you depopulated the territory, why would you have a government for it? Besides, I mean, what kind of an independent government would it be? By the way, you know, among Palestinians themselves these days, nobody is really talking about differences. You know, obviously Hamas and the Palestinian Authority have different views on different things. But how do we bridge any differences, considering that now a slaughter of Palestinians is taking place? By the way, who maintains security while this government supposedly is in charge? Who provides for the well-being of all those people who need desperate help today? Hamas has obviously asked for a ceasefire and release of certain personalities, very, very strong personalities among the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Besides, as for the elections themselves, if Israel were to accept this, that means that Israel has to accept a plan for the elections themselves. Will Israel really accept, for instance, residents of East Jerusalem to participate in these elections, run and vote in these elections? This is why I'm saying it's not realistic and it's not doable.
Israelis still largely stand behind the country's stated goals of crushing Hamas, governing and military capabilities, and releasing the remaining 129 captives. That despite rising international pressure against Israeli offensive and the soaring death toll and unprecedented suffering among Palestinians. Does that mean Israel would reject the Egyptian proposal completely or renegotiate its terms?
Will Israel accept any proposal? Israel is not interested in any resolution that really keeps any parts of Hamas alive. Israel wants a complete annihilation of Hamas, a complete defeat of Hamas. Prime Minister Netanyahu has committed his country to a path of continuous war, because politically speaking, if the war stops, then the end of his political life will probably begin, because he will be under a lot of pressure. He is going to be going to court, and he has lost public approval. Israel may accept parts of this proposal, but it may want basically more amendments to it. I don't think that Israel will accept the fact that the Palestinians would form a technocratic government that is totally independent of them. I doubt that. And wants to keep control over the West Bank. So any other plan that doesn't serve these goals is going to be rejected.
Imad Harb speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Chenawi. Now time for some holiday greetings from our listeners.
Dear listener, by name Peter Yayabol from Ayamarat residential area. Allow me to take this golden opportunity to extend my greeting to all of you over the world. As we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ, may the law of peace and unity prevail to the African countries, and to not forgetting the presenters like James Bute, Douglas Mpoka, Peter Kolote, Michael Wundi, plus Samson Omali in Abuja, Nigeria, and to the rest who are presenting for the technical team. My wishes going to you, all of you, and thank Merry Christmas and Prosperous New Year.
Good day to everyone from VOA. I am Andrew Fefegula from Sierra Leone. I love to listen to VOA, Voice of America. Yes. Greetings to everyone, compliment of the season, and I wish everyone happy, happy, happy belated Christmas and a prosperous New Year in advance. Wishing you all long life and prosperity. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I am Chris Adamene, speaking from Dakama, Mwuhubo, Neusalo Hagamandaria. I want to wish a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to my dear wife, my children and their spouses and grandchildren, all members of Umbebewa Dara family in Umbuhupo, and all staff and students of the Department of Applied Microbiology and Brewing.
Thank you for your greetings. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Pete Huntley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.